Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I have in the studio David Fear and Andy Green from Rolling Stone, and today's topic is biopics and why, in my opinion, even the kind of terrible biopics can be kind of awesome. And totally coincidentally, we're also going to be talking about Bohemian Rhapsody, the new Queen biopic. I will say my favorite part of this movie might be the very beginning, when you hear the 20th Century Fox theme, and it is actually played by Brian May. And then ideally it would be the entire Star Wars theme performed by Brian May, but sadly it was not.
Bicycle.
From there it has its high points and its low points. First of all, there's a lot of factual problems with this movie, right, Andy? Andy has written a story fact-checking it. Some fans are actually mad at Andy for even daring to fact check it.
Right. I mean, I get that any movie, they're going to compress things and to create a dramatic arc to change things around. And I point out things that in many ways are justifiable. But for me, to pretend the band broke up in the early 80s and reformed for Live Aid is so egregious, is so ahistorical that I have a hard time with
it. Well, I have a theory about that. So in real life, in 1984, Queen actually wasn't the only morally problematic show they put at the time, but they booked 12 shows at Sun City in apartheid South Africa, which there already was a musicians union boycott in England of it. It wasn't like they were just too early to know that this was a problem. It was egregious. I mean, luckily they didn't play all the shows. I think Mercury got a cold or something, but that was bad. So in this universe, the universe of the movie, they never played Sun City.
I think they didn't make that choice as screenwriters to just get around the Sun City thing. It's easy just to not mention that.
Yeah, there's poetic license and there's poetic license.
I mean, it adds drama. If you're going to tell the story of not just Freddie Mercury, and I think that that's a thing to get into. So basically, this is a totally sanctioned Queen biopic, and Sacha Baron Cohen left the project specifically because he was supposed to play Freddie Mercury instead of Rami Malek of Mr. Robot fame, who was amazing. But Sacha Baron Cohen was supposed to play him, and he dropped out because the Queen guys were exercising extreme control over the movie.
Yeah, well, it's sort of interesting that Sacha Baron Cohen, he told Howard Stern that the band said to him that they wanted to do a movie in which Freddie dies in the middle, and the second half is their amazing career by the post-Freddie. Whereas the producer of this movie, he told me that was complete fiction, that there was never a moment when they were talking about a movie that didn't end on him dying. So the basic facts of Sasha's dropout are really in dispute. It's sort of interesting.
You can tell from watching it that they wanted it to be the Queen story, not the Freddie Mercury story. And, you know, I think that leads to a bunch of interesting choices, one of which is you hear about his childhood, which was an intriguing childhood and would have been great to see. And instead, you just see a couple photo albums of it. You don't see his parents' forced migration and his going to a boarding school overseas and just stuff that would have been very cinematic. And I thought that was peculiar.
Well, I mean, I think that they were very intent on making a Queen biopic starring Freddie Mercury as opposed to a Freddie Mercury biopic. I interviewed Bryan Singer very, very briefly during the production of this for...
Who directed the movie.
Yes, yeah. Who's the credited director for the movie, yeah.
We can get into that later.
And, you know, I kept saying, so the Freddie Mercury biopic, and he kept correcting me, saying, no, the Queen biopic, it's really about these four guys, and it's really about this. And they had this, I was like, with a very charismatic frontman who, he's like, yes, but they all wrote the songs, and it's very much them in this. And, you know, Andy and I were joking earlier that if you did a drinking game in which every time they had a reaction shot of Brian May in that movie, you would be drunk within the first half hour. It's so clearly, I don't want to cast aspersions, but I feel like the band's fingerprints are all over this movie.
Listen, the critical response to this movie is that it's terrible for the most part, but that Rami Malek is incredible. And I agree with that for the most part because I saw it late in the game and everyone was kind of telling me that this movie just didn't work. Going with those low expectations, I actually really enjoyed it. I found it very campy and amusing, even when it was very awkward. Let's go through some of the most unintentionally hilarious parts. I would say one is when they're writing We Will Rock You. Mm-hmm. And number one, they make this huge point of having Freddie Mercury not in the studio when they begin coming up with it. So he comes in and is like, what's this then?
But, right. But earlier comment about the band's fingerprints
exactly.
All over this
movie. And what's so distracting is he walks in as fully 80s Freddie with the short hair and the mustache. It takes takes place in the 80s when that song is from the 70s when he had the long hair. They moved it like 5 years in the future for no reason.
Details. Yes. Yeah. And then so there's this part, Brian May explains, the Brian May actor, who is that actor?
Oh, I can't remember his name. I could look it up.
I feel like it's like not an actor, like it's, they tried to clone Brian May and it came out sort of like when Bizarro is supposed to be a clone of Superman, but it doesn't come out quite right. It looked
that
like
a, that was a good reference.
He looked more like Howard Stern. Anyway.
Bizarro May.
Yeah, it was Bizarro May. So Bizarro May is standing there and he's like explaining something that does not need to be explained at great length, and then he actually explains it twice. He's like,
guys,
he's like,
we need a call and response song.
He's like, you see, when we play a concert, there is also an audience. And in the audience, perhaps, could be given something to do. And I realize the audience do not have musical instruments. However, one thing they could perhaps do, and it's just, you're, then when Freddie comes in and he sees them stomping and clapping, and again, he's completely baffled. He's like, what are you doing? So then Bizarro Brian May takes the opportunity to explain all of this again.
Yeah. I mean, which is the actual Brian May just trying to tell the world, I wrote We Will Rock You, Freddie Mercury did not.
Yes, and not only that, but they make a point of having Freddie go, tell me, what are the lyrics? Just to make clear that he had no creative part in We Will Rock You. But again, rather than being repulsed by this, I was really, really deeply amused. I think it should be a YouTube clip for all eternity. Oh, there's another part where he's playing a Love of My Life on the piano. You know, it includes the words Love of My Life maybe 30 times. Uh-huh. And then the dude goes, it's beautiful. What is it called? And he's like, very solemnly goes, Love of My Life. And it's just, there's something about that that just, I just laughed out loud in the theater. And that, let's talk about that character. So there's this character who's becomes his solo manager. He's another gay guy, mm-hmm. and he's portrayed as all that is evil. He pulls Freddie into the world of decadence, and but even worse, of not appreciating the other Queen guys quite as much as he should.
That's the original sin.
The original sin of all mankind, of course. So is that a real thing? Who is that guy?
Yeah, it was real. It was distorted. He did have that character in his life that did go public and talk about their relationship, but to make him just the spawn of Satan, I think, was not quite accurate.
They have him calling, they're like, we've got to play Live Aid, and he's just like, yeah, I'll tell him, and then like hangs up the phone. Of course, that is another total fiction. Let's hear Love of My Life for a second.
You've broken my heart, and now you leave me, love of my life.
Can't imagine what that song would be called.
Yeah.
What other parts struck you as slightly unintentionally hilarious? And we're also being joined by Brittany Spanos in the studio.
Okay, I'll tell you what my favorite scene in the entire film is. So there's this fictional character. I believe he's fictional, right? The Mictor?
Let's dig into this.
He's based off somebody real, but they changed the name and changed everything else.
Right, so he's this conspicuously Scottish music executive sitting in this office dealing with Queen, and he's asking for another hit. They've just had, I forget what the hit was.
It was Killer Queen.
It was Killer Queen. He's like, we need another Killer Queen. And Freddie Mercury is getting very agitated, and he says, we don't just, you know, spit out these hits. We don't just work according to a formula. At which point, in thick Scottish brogue, Mike Myers yells at the band, and by extension, us, formulas work! At which point, it's the most meta moment in that movie. It is burying the lead. It is self-owning right there.
I will go ahead and disagree with you, because the most meta moment in the movie comes moments later when Myers character goes, and I won't do the Scottish accent, but he's talking about Bohemian Rhapsody, and he's, I guess maybe it's in the next scene, they deliver Bohemian Rhapsody, he's talking about it, and he's like, no two teenagers will ever sit in a car and headbang to this song, and you're just like, why did
wink,
you do that?
Wink, nudge.
Like, weirdly, they did one of those 4D things, and my chair actually rumbled at that moment, just in case you didn't get it. Yeah, it's one of those things where you understand the impulse, right? It's so cute, but at some point, someone should have been like, no, just don't do it. It's not just taking you out of the movie, it's just like shoving you out of the theater. It was vaguely horrifying in its clumsiness. And all those scenes, actually, of them, the scenes that weren't even sort of campily funny but just didn't work, were of people sitting in a conference room, because that's not Bryan Singer's strength. There's never a scene in the X-Men movies where they're just sitting around like having coffee. And
I feel
that
there's a director's cut of the second X-Men movie where it's a lot of mutants just sitting around conference rooms wondering what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Wondering where their next Killer Queen is.
I guess that in a movie it's like this, you need villains, they need to rise above stuff. So there's a fake record executive, they throw a brick through his window, they refuse to compromise on their art.
Yeah, they could have murdered Mike Myers' character. this is bizarre moment of just like all of a sudden they're Johnny Rotten. They're throwing a totally fictional, I don't know, was it really a brick? I don't know if it was
a rock.
A brick.
I don't know.
They're throwing a totally fictional projectile through the window of a totally fictional executive and to make themselves look cool.
I sort of hope it was a rock because then that was how they came up with We Will Rock You.
Oh, that was,
the eureka moment we really needed in this movie. Yeah.
What's interesting, I was going to ask you, David Fear, as sort of a historian of film, what are some other examples in general of a truly great performance, perhaps even Oscar worthy, he might get nominated, I think, in a movie that's in a movie that's not so good.
Oh God,
there's a lot, obviously.
Well, you're opening up, I mean, let's just keep this to music biopics, right? Okay. Because you're opening up a supermarket's worth of a can of worms. I mean, the two things that everyone kind of gloms onto immediately are Joaquin Phoenix's Johnny Cash and Walk the Line, and
that is not a bad movie. That is not a bad movie. But go on.
Well, I think okay. Yeah. Let me skew a couple clicks to the left. Then,
do you really think that's a bad movie?
No, I think it's an okay biopic. I think it was smart of them to focus on Johnny Cash and June Carter as the focus, as opposed to just doing a standard cradle-to-grave film of Johnny Cash, which, that movie is as well. It literally starts in his childhood and then, you know, has the great posthumous thing of, like, he got better from drugs, and then he made a couple albums, and then he died, and here's the real Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
Wrong
kid died.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And then Jamie Foxx and Ray is what everyone points out, which I will suggest is not the greatest biopic ever.
See, dude, those movies are so much better than this movie, first of all. Although they did combine to create Walk Hard, which is a greater achievement. But,
which brings us to another question. How can you make a music biopic after Walk Hard?
Well, that's funny. You're getting ahead of ourselves, but I actually asked James Mangold that, who directed Walk the Line, as well as Logan, if we're talking X-Men. But I asked James Mangold about that, and he's a little bit sensitive about Walk Hard, because the studio that made Walk Hard turned down Walk the Line and then went on to make the parody. Not only that, but gave Walk Hard, according to him, a bigger budget than Walk the Line had. So actually, you can understand. I mean, he thinks the movie's funny, which it is. It's very absolutely funny, hilarious. Yeah. But you can understand, actually, when you hear that, why he would be a little bit irked, not at Walk Hard, but at the studio. I mean, James Mangold was like, look, anything can become cliched. You just either execute it or you don't. And I think that's true. And I think his theory, and he's still looking for exactly what you said, key parts of bands or singers' existences that you can turn into a tight movie rather than the birth to the grave kind of biopic.
Yeah, when they make the inevitable official Kurt Cobain biopic, I wonder whether they're going to do...
Oy.
Yeah, I mean, some people count Gus Van Sant's Last Days as kind of an unofficial look at, you know, the final days of Kurt Cobain, which I don't, you know, have a problem with. I actually think if you look at it that way, it makes for a nice kind of fake biopic.
I saw that movie. I completely forgot about it. Yeah.
Yeah. But when they make the official, you know, About a Boy, the movie, the story of Kurt Cobain biopic, I kind of wonder. I wonder whether they're going to start with him being a kid and then working up through his punk days and then his fame and then his disillusionment with fame and then his kind of flame out. Or if they're going to do, you know, what is kind of the second... There's actually three ways you can do a biopic, a music biopic, we found. You can do the cradle to grave stuff, which is your Ray, your Walk the Line. You can focus on one element. And it's funny because a music biopic doesn't come to mind when I think about this, but I think of Capote, where you don't look at all of Truman Capote's life. You just look at him going from being a New York bon vivant to becoming the author of In Cold Blood and kind of reinventing the notion of like a true crime novel. Or you can do the kind of like collage, mix-up, match-up, take a bunch of things and kind of throw it in there and hope that you make an impressionist biopic, which like I'm Not There, I think, is like the great example, if not the greatest example of this.
You know, that said, I would rather, much rather watch Walk the Line personally than I'm Not There Again. But we can agree to differ. You're a cineast.
People can't see this in Radioland, but I'm actually smoking a pipe right now. And I have on one of those college professor jackets with the elbow patches. So
I'll say
stroking my beard.
I'll say exactly what James Mangold told me. I asked him, after the parody of Walk Hard, does the idea of the conventional music biopic need to be? And he said, rethought? I don't know. I think you could say the same thing about the Western and Blazing Saddles. I think it's really important that filmmakers never lose sight of the fact that the only reason satire is powerful is that the form they're making fun of is powerful. I think he's absolutely right. And that's sort of what I was getting at the beginning, is that there's something inherent about, for me, about the music biopic format that can survive even the truly ridiculous. And I think we've talked about the show The Doors by Oliver Stone. There's something about watching the rise and fall and the exhilaration of it that just works cinematically. I think the same way I don't like sports, but I love sports movies for the same reason.
Right. Yeah. But I think the central problem with so many of them is you're having actors play some of the most iconic people that have ever lived. If they lip sync, it looks a little ridiculous. If they sing themselves, it can sound horrible. You lose the magic off. And I think the Queen movie is very effective at this. But I think most of them, when you watch somebody else play John Lennon or whatever, as soon as they start singing, you lose the illusion.
I was going to make some kind of Guns N' Roses joke, as we'll learn when Lil Xan plays Axl Rose in the inevitable biopic. Poor Rami Malek is having a hard time in the press right now. Some of it very self-created, as Brittany pointed out. He seems to be kind of bummed out that he really gave a very hardcore effort to recreating Freddie Mercury. And you were saying he worked with movement coaches and all sorts of things, and he delivered. I think no one has quibbled with the greatness of his performance, but everyone's kind of quibbling with the movie, and I think he's upset about it. And then we should say that Bryan Singer, the director of this movie, who, as we mentioned, is famous for directing various X-Men movies, some of which I like very much, had some personal issues during the movie. He's surrounded by rumors and personal issues, but he just, you know, as one does, didn't show up for a couple days of shooting the movie, and that was a problem, and then was
90% of it done in the middle of a scene.
And, you know, hey, it happens. You know, Scorsese only shows up about 90% of the time, and then all those movies come out.
True story.
Yeah, but that was a problem. He said he was taking care of an elderly parent. That's been disputed. And then the studio actually yanked his production credit, I guess, as punishment, although he kept the directing credit. Some of the movie was not even directed by him. And then we sort of know that he clashed with Rami Malek. We don't know that much about it. In fact, the only thing that Rami Malek has sort of admitted to as a creative dispute, which is weird given something I'll say in a second, is he says that if it was up to him, the movie would have focused more on Freddie as a gay man. Now, that's interesting. And he, you know, said, I fought really hard. Brittany, as you were pointing out, on the other hand, he said some other stuff.
Yeah, I think he's sort of been going back and forth in the press and not really knowing how to address it. I mean, he's sort of indicated that Freddie was, that he wasn't gay in some interviews. And he did say, like he said, like, oh, he's really private. We can't really assume anything, or we can't really say anything about his life, and he'd want it that way. And I think in some ways kind of defending aspects of the movie or aspects of what people were expecting from the film, and also trying to appease what are greater truths about Freddie that we know.
So someone was saying that when people said Freddie was a gay icon, Rami would say a human icon, and that seems ill-advised.
The IndieWire interview, I think that's been happening numerous times, and I think the idea being that in their mind, you can't just think of him as a gay icon. I don't know if they're saying that because of what we were saying before about his private sexuality. I don't know if they don't want to turn off potential viewers in 2018. I don't know why the reason is, but I will say that when I did talk to Singer, he kept saying, oh, this is such a personal project for me. This was right after they were in production. They just finished filming the Live Aid stuff and were getting ready to, because they filmed that first. And he had said, it's such a personal movie for me. And I said, oh, well, why? What's your personal connection to Queen? And he says, you know, as a young gay man looking at Freddie Mercury, he was very much a gay icon, and he was someone who I looked up to. He was someone who flouted his sexuality and didn't admit to it. And that I'm proud to, like, tell this story of this person who's so important to my community.
And then he added, but maybe he wasn't gay. We don't know.
Yeah, he was very private. We don't know. Hard to say.
Factually speaking, there's evidence that Freddie might have thought he was bi. You know, there was a woman he had a, quote, passionate affair with in the 80s. So, and then Bryan Singer himself said he was dating a woman 2 years ago. So people's sexualities are complicated. So, but the movie handles the whole thing in a little bit of a peculiar way. It's a PG-13 movie. I think there was a fear when they, in the first trailer, they showed him with the woman he married and never with any men, and people were freaking out, understandably, that this was going to be just a total insane straight watching of one of the most famous gay men who ever lived. But no, it's not like that. But because of the PG-13 thing, and because of reasons I can't even begin to guess at, there's something stagey about the way that his gay life is handled.
It's very chaste hedonism, which seems very odd, especially when you combine it with what seems to be like a community college production of Cruising when he goes to a leather bar.
Yes, it's the same leather bar from The Sopranos, I think. It's weird in that it is directed, that Bryan Singer, you know, is a proud gay man, and it's directed like someone who's never met a gay person sometimes, and it's just weird. But I think it's basically like, imagine it's this guy's friends who were never perhaps totally comfortable with this aspect of his life, guiding writing the movie. Right. And so I think that that's definitely what... And so, yeah, again, it wasn't so much that he lost himself in decadence as he was neglecting the band. That's what they were worried about. But yeah.
And yeah, I think of that scene at the truck stop when he sort of catches eyes with that guy as he's walking into the bathroom.
He's on the phone. He's on the phone with his wife.
Right? Yeah, right. Just so ham-fisted and it's kind of hard to watch.
It's just peculiar how it doesn't feel... or it just feels inorganic and just not well done, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, nor does it feel salacious either. It's kind of very weird. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. There was that scene like in the beginning when he first meets Mary and it's like a guy checks him out and then like he meets her and he checks her out. It's like very, I think they wanted to sort of attempt the complexities of his own sexuality, his own identity, which I think would have been a better movie to kind of dig deep into that. And I think that it felt like an afterthought to a lot of sort of like the band mythology building and everything that they were attempting to do with the actual structure of the film. But
I mean, what was it like to be a closeted gay man in one of the biggest rock bands in the world in the middle of like Cock Rock Arena Central? Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
and well, hide an AIDS diagnosis for years.
This is an interesting question for you, Andy. Do you think it is true that when Freddie grew his mustache and cut his hair, that fans threw razors on stage? This is one of the most repeated things. It's in Michael Gilmore's story for us. I just don't believe that actually happened.
It may have happened a time or two, then it gets exaggerated. I don't know for sure.
Because think about that. They had to bring the razors. They had to get the razors all the way to the front of the arena. They had to, like,
meet the security back then.
I don't know.
I seem preoccupied with the planning of this.
I just don't buy it. It seems like a myth. They're very small objects. He had to kneel down and be like, why, this is a razor. They want me to, I don't know. It just seems like bullshit to me. I'm sorry. That said, if you have a myth that good, why would you not include it in the movie? I was just picturing this like nightmarish slow-mo onslaught of razors, which is how this movie would handle it if it did, because there's a press conference scene that's it's another one that veers on self-parody.
It's the strangest press conference of all time. It's a press conference where the journalists are just going after him like maniacs about his sexuality, which is unlike any press conference in the history of mankind. And it's so hostile.
And I guess he did have a thing of parrying with the press, but they have him like he's Dylan in 65. Yeah. He goes, oh, your parents proud of you. Yeah. Like it's just like I don't know, it seemed like all of a sudden it was another character altogether. But it's also, they were doing a lot of like surreal sort of like the flashbulbs are flashing and it's all in slow-mo and
I'm
it's just
so disoriented.
And you actually, it seemed like it's building to someone passing out. That's usually what would happen, right? or maybe peeing himself like Star is Born. It seemed like it was going somewhere but it didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, it's just all these questions of just like, are you gay, sir?
At long last, are you gay, sir?
At some press event, which is always just fluff questions.
The only thing that was completely realistic is the Brian May going, does anyone have any questions about the music? And that is real as hell. That is definitely how it goes. We did make an album, you know. Tell that to Johnny Mars fans the other week. Overall, I think what I felt worked, and Brittany was saying this, is all the performances. And in fact, it worked to the extent that I think it's one of those movies in like, you know, 5-10 years, we're given now like 2 years, you'll be hearing from some kid who's like, I decided to start like a rock band because I saw Bohemian Rhapsody. And that's no small thing, as much as we've been totally clowning on this movie. I thought it was actually did as well as anything I've seen recently to cinematically remind people of like this sort of power of a live rock band. That's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah, I think Rami fully grasped the charisma that made Freddie Mercury so legendary and iconic during that time and still now. And the extended scene with Live Aid, I loved that, made the entire film kind of okay. So
it's funny, I was talking before the show with Alan Light, our Rolling Stone colleague, who also is a host here on Volume, and he really didn't like the fact that he devoted so much time to Live Aid. My counter argument was that Live Aid was like 34 years ago.
Yeah,
a lot of the younger people seeing this movie are not familiar with Live Aid, and Live Aid itself was not able to be filmed so dramatically. And Live Aid also had the disadvantage of having actual people in the audience rather than a CGI crowd that sometimes looks super fake. But right. I totally got it, and I thought it was pretty thrilling, honestly.
Yeah,
and there was a major, major moment in their career. It was the first time where you saw the group play for anything more than like 20 seconds or something, so you really got the power of the band at the very end.
That said, part of me really wanted the camera to start roaming elsewhere backstage and show like Bob Dylan and Ron Wood getting drunk before they went on, and just...
That was in Philadelphia.
Okay.
You just got fact-checked.
The camera could roam really far over to Philadelphia.
They got Dire Straits right, because they played Salt into Swimming at the end of their set before Queen, and you could hear that in their trailer. So I enjoyed that.
That's cool. And as far as accuracy, the guys who played the musicians did have their fingers in the right places. Like, I especially noticed that with Bizarre Brian May, that he's down to, like, if the pinky and the ring finger would be used to play a solo as a guitar player, I noticed he nailed that. And that's unusual, actually, right, to that extent.
And John Deacon's haircut at Live Aid is the worst haircut in the history of haircuts.
Oh, right,
and
the weird puffy.
They got it perfect. So that was well done.
I think points for accuracy. You know, I will say this, that one of the early criticisms that we heard once the reviews started trickling out for this was that as impressive as the Live Aid set was in the film, people kept saying, they act like you can't go on YouTube and watch all like 16 minutes of this. But A, I think it was interesting that you brought up the idea that a lot of younger people wouldn't necessarily know about this. And to see that, to see what is considered, if not the greatest, one of the three greatest live, you know, sets ever recorded is major. It's absolutely very major. And anybody can sit and ape. I can do a great air guitar right now of, you know, We Will Rock You, and it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm capturing the spirit of being on that stage with those three other people in front of thousands of folks, absolutely, like, giving them the power of rock. And I think the way that it shows all this and keeps with it and how they sustain this entire set in the performance is really like the highlight of the movie, mm-hmm, by far.
Bryan Singer is a fan of these totally faked CG shots that sometimes can be really cool. He had one in the last X-Men movie that was like that. Sorry, but we're mostly talking about X-Men. But there's a shot where the camera basically, in my memory, basically goes from the top of the stadium all the way to Freddie Mercury's piano. And I actually thought that was really cool, because that's what you, in a stadium concert, if you're like at the top of the stadium, that's what you wish, is that you could like zoom, yep, in that close and see like the dust on the piano. And that was really cool. And it made me think that there's actually more to be done with sort of really cool concert based scenes.
It's the difference between recreating the broadcast of that set from Live Aid and recreating what it was actually like to be on that stage. And I, like you said, really wonderfully right now, like that's what you want as a fan. That's what you want when you're an audience and you want to be on that stage with Queen. And the fact that they actually do that and don't make it just seem like the most epic karaoke session you've ever seen is an accomplishment.
And it's hard to balance that. You know, you need to get to that, and then you have all this other stuff, like we said, of people sitting around talking. We've discussed this before in Star Is Born and other things. There's nothing more inherently dramatically dangerous as far as like getting inadvertent laughs as the process of creating something, especially something you already know about. I've used this example before, but I just love it so much, where Brittany writes, quote unquote, not a girl, not yet a woman in the movie Crossroads is the ultimate example of this, where you just watch them compose and it's just inherently ridiculous. And there's a few. What did you think of the scene where Rami sits down and is sort of works himself into a trance and does the beginning of Bohemian Rhapsody? Did that work for you or no?
When he's under the piano when, yeah, he was with Mary?
No,
when he was in the studio.
No, when he's out, yeah, walking in the field, then he comes in and starts playing it on,
yeah,
piano.
I thought that was somewhat effective. I thought that the making of that song, that wasn't too ridiculous the way it was presented.
Did those scenes work for you?
Yeah, I like the kind of montage of them recording Bohemian Rhapsody. But the other ones, it felt like so excessive because it did feel like, hey, this band member wrote this song, just,
oh, yeah,
so you know.
Absolutely.
But like that one felt like a really good band moment in a film.
That's a great point. That was a really cool moment. There were some very funny things where they're, who's the one who sings the Galileo part?
That was Roger Taylor.
Roger Taylor. Their direction to him on the Galileo thing was just higher, as if, yeah, that's how you communicate musically. Like, just like not ease, like a fifth higher, not an octave higher, just, yeah, higher. You know, it doesn't really, yeah, matter what note, just higher. It's just like laughable.
What's sort of interesting is to end it at Live Aid when you could argue that the most dramatic part of his whole life was the final years as he's dying, mm-hmm, of AIDS, and he's still making music as hard as he can. They're making innuendo as he's dying.
Well, you see, because that's the Freddie Mercury biopic, starts with his childhood, yeah, and ends with him in his final years. The Queen biopic ends at Live Aid.
But they toured the next year and it was so awesome, and then they made so much.
Right, but the dramatic peak, though, is, and that might be the problem. Do we think that there's any chance that it's true what Sacha Baron Cohen said, that the original screenplay had Freddie die halfway through the movie?
No. When I spoke to the producer, he was very convincing that every single version of every script, every discussion, that is him dying or Live Aid, that to do half the movie about the Paul Rogers tour of like 2005 would have been the most ridiculous thing. So like they're watching Bad Company.
And you would have loved that movie.
I want part two where it's all about the Paul Rogers era.
I want the sequel that's like all about Adam Lambert.
Where they're driving the car. They're like, okay, we need a new singer. Then on comes Bad Company. They're like, hey. When they've told me since then, that he was a huge mistake. It was the wrong sound. Whereas Adam Lambert, however, is the
perfect
singer.
Well, he is much better than
he's
for
much,
them than,
he's
than
much,
Paul Rodgers.
Much better.
Yeah. Paul Rodgers is like they picked him out of the phone book, basically. It's a bizarre choice.
You know, I think he was willing to say yes. He brought some of his own hits to it. But they recorded a new album of new songs with him that's been completely forgotten.
So is there footage on YouTube of like Paul Rodgers singing All Right Now with Queen?
Oh, yeah.
That exists?
It sure does. And I think they did feel like Making Love also.
What about Radioactive?
No, but I think the song Bad Company, they played, so it's Queen performing like Bad Company's Bad Company. It's so bizarre.
Did they perform songs by The Firm?
No, it was mainly Queen songs. It was a fiasco, and their new album is the most forgotten album that's ever been made by a big band.
So there was a Queen Paul Rodgers album.
Of all new songs. It's been erased from history.
Well, see, this was a great 20 minutes of the screenplay. The recording of that album, the songwriting, how they signed the record contract. Yeah. Who signed it first? Did Paul Rodgers sign? How did they negotiate the royalties? This would have been covered.
Did they call the band Freen?
No, it was Queen plus Paul Rodgers, and now it's Queen plus Adam Lambert.
So anyway, you believe them. You don't think that there was some deranged plan to make a Queen biopic that ended happy yet?
I love Sacha Baron Cohen. I want to believe him on that, but it's ridiculous. I mean, I just can't imagine a screenplay where half of it is finding Paul Rodgers.
I think knowing Sacha Baron Cohen, he picked an idea that he knew that was hilarious, and he picked it because people would remember it, and it makes them look so ridiculous.
Well, then
he might have had an axe to grind, too.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
He picked the scenario in which they look hilariously stupid and then beat it to grind that axe.
Exactly. And I was told by the producer that they didn't want a white guy, that he thought that that was a bad idea.
Well, they didn't want one, except they signed one. And then after he left, they said they didn't want one. But I think that would have been a mistake, yeah, for sure. But I think that they're only retroactively saying
that. He said they didn't ever sign Sacha Baron Cohen, that they're just talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
Was his version of events.
My guess is that Sacha Baron Cohen's breaking point was the teeth.
Yeah.
Yes, and let's talk briefly about the teeth. The teeth are... I was saying that the teeth are very impressive. I was saying that if they make the parody of this movie, the teeth need to get bigger every scene.
Yeah.
More mercury molars.
Best supporting actor.
Yeah, when I spoke to Rami, he said the moment that they put the teeth in is the moment that he felt like Freddy. That for him, it was extremely important that each morning on the set, when they'd put the teeth in, he'd become Freddy.
So, you know, he, I guess, had extra room in his mouth, which in reality probably did create some real resonance, like it created a more resonant voice. But in the movie, they have him saying it gave him more range. And I was saying in the break that drives me insane. It would not give him more range. It would increase the resonance of his voice. Range of your singing does not come from your mouth. That's not how singing works. You don't sing from your mouth. Like, come on. I thought it's a bunch of musicians who made this. All right. So we're this
but not is, singers.
Yeah, not singers. Well, no, but they are singers. They sing great background vocals.
Yeah.
But that's the weird thing is they sing entirely from their mouth. There's no vocal cords involved. That's how Brian May sings. He's an astrophysicist and he figured this out.
They sing entirely from their mouth.
That's right. Now, we've been poking a little fun at Bohemian Rhapsody, although, as I said, I still enjoyed it, but, you know, the critics have not been kind, and it has its moments of silliness. It's too bad that we're giving it a hard time because it plays into a history between Queen and Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone, back in the day, and, you know, I think we'd all acknowledge now that Queen was a great and important band. Back in the day, as actually has been discussed in Ancient History on this podcast, Rolling Stone's critics were especially hostile to Queen. Dave Marsh, the legendary critic, once wrote that they were perhaps rock's first truly fascist band, which was, you know, what he was responding to was, you know, kind of like, we are the champions, and not hearing the sort of the gay man subtext to it or anything. And just and we will rock you, just hearing it that way. But, you know, so that was perhaps unkind. And I will say that when I did talk to Brian May when I first started Rolling Stone, and I talked to him actually about the Paul Rodgers tour, that actually did happen. And we were on the phone, and the first thing he said is, how long have you been at Rolling Stone? And I was like, 2 weeks. And he's like, okay, good, we can talk, you know, because I didn't, not now, of course, after this podcast, I'm back on the bad list. But there was a terrible relationship with Queen and Rolling Stone, and they never were on the cover. The truth is, they also were not a critically beloved band in general, and this is the only music biopic I've ever seen that included the bad reviews they got, and it was specifically for Bohemian Rhapsody, I guess, to kind of point out how, quote-unquote, wrong all the critics were.
Yeah, I think that they were a very British band, and they're always bigger overseas. In the movie, he says that he doesn't want to tour America again because of their response to the video where they're in drag. But in reality, they didn't tour the States on less like three tours because they weren't selling tickets. You know, I think that the Rolling Stone critics just saw them as a British hard rock band that wasn't the kind of stuff that they liked it all.
Not socially conscious, you know, and I understand where they were coming from. I think that it was largely misguided.
Oh, yeah. I think it was hugely misguided. It's just, I think that they were so popular, and they got popular so quickly, and so much of it was just, you know, boom, boom, ch, boom, boom, ch, that to some old school rock critic is just, like, garbage, you know.
Well, for an old school rock critic, too, was it the kind of blending of genres they were doing in stuff like A Night at the Opera that was throwing them off as well?
I think they were seen as a prog band, which is a little unfair, and they were all despised. You know, it was just not the kind of stuff that your Dave Marsh's thought was great music. It was not Bruce Springsteen. It was not Bob Dylan. It was not John Lennon. It was populist stadium crap in their minds.
Tacky, with lyrics that didn't mean anything, just superficial.
And for teenagers.
Yeah, for teenagers. Superficial technical accomplishments without meaning anything, that kind of thing. That was not the... But in the end, I mean, you know, who had a better guitar tone than Brian May? And I personally was disappointed that there wasn't a scene of his dad chopping down their fireplace or whatever to make his guitar. That is one of the coolest things of all time. How do you not even include...
It's director's cut.
Yeah, in all seriousness, like, if you want to make the movie about the other guys, how come they never have any arc whatsoever? I think even if a movie made just about Freddie Mercury might have given more of a subplot to give distinct personality. Mm. The only thing they do is make sure that we know that the bass player got laid a lot. That seemed to be one of the things that they really wanted to get across. I feel like that was his note. It'd be like, but what about the sex I was having? It's
funny too how it keeps toggling between being a frontman biopic and a band biopic, and I think that's one of its problems, in fact, is it never quite figures out exactly what it wants to be.
When I spoke to the producer, he said that they went through so many screenplays year after year after year, very different takes on it, that just to find a 2-hour version with a good arc was just torturous. So I imagine that they tried everything.
Brittany, seemed like you were gonna say something.
No, yeah, I mean, I think it lost both sides of that. Like, it lost kind of like the idea of building a great band story versus building a great Freddie story, because I think that it's really comes down to choosing one or the other.
If you put Rami Malek into a really gritty, complex, R-rated version of Freddie Mercury's life that still had the Live Aid stuff and still had the thing, I think in the end, we'll see. It's possible that would have even been a better commercial decision.
But it's doing shockingly well.
We'll see. Yeah,
I think maybe if they made it R and families can go see it, it wouldn't become this thing now that it's doing shockingly well. It's going to be a big hit.
I think if this kicks off any trend, it's going to be music biopics starring Rami Malek. So he'll play Robert Plant in the Zeppelin story. He'll play Syd Barrett in the Pink Floyd story.
Because it's really just about swapping out the teeth. If he just he can actually play any part.
Tight trousers and teeth, yeah.
With the right teeth, he can play Aretha Franklin.
Controversial.
Controversial, but I'll say it. Aretha, by the way, sang at Freddie's funeral, so that's interesting. Yeah. This has been today's Rolling Stone Music Now. I would still actually recommend you see Bohemian Rhapsody. We'll be back next week, if everyone else is shaking their head, here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, we are a podcast. Download us as a podcast. Subscribe to us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes. And we'll see you next Friday. And as always, thanks for listening.